Okay.
Okay, so let's go ahead and call the February 19th special meeting of the Mill Creek City Council to order, and we'll begin with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mayor Pruitt?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw?
Here.
Councilmember Bond?
Here.
Councilmember Todd?
Here.
Councilmember Cavallari?
Here.
Councilmember Steckler?
Here.
Councilmember Vignier?
Here.
Darn. I even asked you before.
Okay, so first up is going to be audience communication. And you can talk about anything on the agenda, not on the agenda. 3 minutes, name and address. And just so you know, we're going to have, as you can see from our agenda, a study session after the audience communication. And we won't be taking audience communication or questions or anything during that session. That's for the council and the people in the audience to learn what we're going to be looking at, or what the project is. So if you have questions that you would like answered, and that's what you're here for tonight, feel free to ask them during the audience communication, and staff will respond at a later time. Or it may come up during the presentation tonight. And we're going to have, there'll be another meeting probably next Tuesday for the development.
Potentially, that's our tentative schedule right now, is to have the development agreement come before council on the 26th. As you know, development in this area also requires a public hearing, and so that has not been scheduled yet, but there'll be more opportunities for public engagement. In addition, an open house, the developer is proposing, and some of this you're going to hear in a few minutes, tomorrow night as well.
Okay, so we'll have audience communication at the end of the meeting. And we will also have audience communication at every one of our meetings, plus we're going to have a public hearing. So this is not the end. This is our first time seeing the project, too. And we have a lot of work left to do. So with that, nobody signed up. Was there only one sheet?
Thanks.
Okay, nobody signed up. You guys probably all didn't come here tonight just to watch us have fun. So who would like to talk to the council first? Sir, name and address.
Okay. My name is Larry Allen. I'm representing the Homeowners Association, the Board of Directors of the Homeowners Association at Bluegrass Meadows. My address is 13610 43rd Avenue Southeast here in Mill Creek. We just have a couple of questions that at some point we'd like to get answers to. And it all comes down to, how does the project affect school assignments? What impact is it going to have on Penny Creek or any of the other schools in the district? We're curious about how police and emergency response times may or may not be affected. And I understand that there's been some conversation about a substation for the police department, but that was taken off the table for reasons I'm not clear on. And we'd like to know if that can be resurrected, or does it need to be resurrected? We're curious about, and this sounds judgmental, and I don't mean it to, but you know, do similar projects, how do they affect crime rates in the area? Congestion only gets worse in our neck of the woods, and it's an issue that's come up. Lastly, traffic congestion. How is it going to affect State Route 96, east and west of the site, and also traffic on Seattle Hill Road? We are seeing, I realize it's a temporary problem, but with the 35th Avenue project ongoing, Seattle Hill Road has been no fun. So those are some questions that we would like to try to get some answers to, if we may. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything next? Anything next?
My name's Don Armstrong. I live in the Mill Creek Development, 14131 11th Drive Southeast. I'll tell you what I do know. When I am on 128th on the west side of the freeway and starting around 3 o'clock, Traffic is so congested it's almost impossible to pass through. Green light comes on. Maybe two cars will get through that green light while the rest sit and watch and sit and watch and sit and watch. What I don't know is huge. One is, how many new apartments have been built on that stretch from approximately Lowe's through the end of, it's no longer 128th, I don't remember what street that is, but 128th turns into 196th or something like that. How many apartments, not apartment building, but apartments have been built on that stretch of road in the last 5 years? What kind of assessment has been done as to what it will do to affect traffic? How many minutes are we going to have to be waiting at the stoplights on that road? I want some answers to those kinds of questions, but nobody has those kinds of answers. And then, of course, the more immediate question or the follow-on question is, how is it going to affect traffic to build the farm? How many new apartments are there? That's answerable. I had that number once. I don't know what it is now, but I think it's undefined, but some estimates. How is that going to affect traffic? What is it going to do to the average wait time at traffic lights? Nobody even asks those kinds of questions, and nobody has any of those answers that I know of. But I want those answers. And I don't care if it's judgmental or not. My family, my daughter, my granddaughter live in the area, and having that number of apartments does affect crime. Look at the crime statistics of the apartments off Dumas Road. I lived here when all of that was wooded area. Every time I read a newspaper, I see two or three police responses to those areas without end. Do you think that'll get better with more and more and more apartments? It won't. We all know it won't. At what point do you think citizens are ready to get seriously violent about destroying our lives? It's time to put a stop. It's past time to put a stop. Give us answers to how you think that's really going to impact our lives, our livelihood, our crime rates, our traffic. And we want those answers before we make agreements. And I frankly suspect certain agreements have already been made that can't be turned around. That's what I believe. So what is it we can do? How can we mitigate the plans that have already been approved and others want to continue? We don't have the information, and we need it. But we do know it will dramatically affect our lives in a negative direction. Thank you.
Good evening. Carmen Fisher, 14623 Main Street, B101. I just want to say briefly that I strongly support any project that brings workforce housing to Mill Creek. Local workers are the lifeblood of communities, and this is the philosophy that's driving a national movement towards inclusion of workforce housing into development everywhere as an important part of growing healthy communities. Some professions these units could target include nurses' assistants, teachers, pharmacy technicians, receptionists, administrative assistants, countless other professions that contribute to quality of life in Mill Creek. And I think that those hardworking people deserve the opportunity to share this community with us. Population growth is inevitable. You know, there are going to be more units. Snohomish is going to keep getting more and more crowded. So let's just make sure it's smart growth. Because it's so desirable, workforce housing tends to have higher occupancy rates and lower turnover than unrestricted rentals. And this is perfect for a tight-knit community like Mill Creek, where we want people to move here and then we keep them and make them family. All right, thank you.
Okay, anybody else? Going once? Okay, with that, we'll go ahead and move on to our study session. Bob?
Thank you, Mayor. So tonight's study session, this is the first opportunity that Council is going to have to hear about the farm development. We structured this study session in two parts. The first part is for staff to just provide you an overview of the process that we're going to be utilizing or you're going to be utilizing as you consider the development proposal. And the second part is for the developer to present his vision for the project and also to describe what he believes to be the benefits associated with the proposal. So that's the agenda for tonight. And City Planner Christine Emily is going to lead off, and she's going to provide you an overview associated with the process. As you know, this is in the EGAB area, and our development must be consistent with those underlying policies, codes, and regulations that have long been established for North Creek. And that's what we're going to be utilizing as we evaluate this project and as it proceeds to the development agreement stage and then beyond. So, Christy?
Well, good evening, Mayor. Good evening, City Council.
Thank you for the opportunity to tonight to present. I'm going to go ahead and I'll just squeeze in up here. Thank you, Tina, for loading the PowerPoint presentation. Well, we get to read the news tonight. I would like to thank those in the audience who spoke up this evening. And while I'm at my PowerPoint presentation, I would like to let you know that if you haven't already, please go to the project page for... We'll hide the news.
Could you click on the Dolly Parton story?
Great dress. Thank you. So if you haven't yet, please go to the city's webpage. There is a project page for this particular proposal. If you haven't registered, I encourage you to, because you will receive public notices and information updates about the project. So your question about traffic, that is there in the traffic report, down to seconds at the lights. So I just okay. Well, I'll go ahead and get started here. We'll go back to the beginning. So the purpose of staff's presentation this evening is to provide the City Council and the public with background information and the history on how the East Gateway area was developed and the sub-area plan was adopted. And also to introduce the developer here this evening, we have Ryan Patterson is here with Vintage and also his architect, Chris
Could
Olson.
Can you speak into the mic, please?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Thank you. So we'll cover background information on eGov, and along with that, as part of that, the master development plan review process. Let me get my mic set. I can do a little cord maneuvering. There we go. So after the development review process, I'll go ahead and touch on where the farm at Mill Creek is currently in the status, their review process, followed by the presentation by the applicant and the architect. We're going to take a little trip back in time about 11 years ago. In 2008, the City Council at that time, they went ahead and they adopted the sub-area plan for the East Gateway area. This was comprised of three different key elements to begin the process. After the community had a visioning process, they decided they came to an agreement on a plan. The City Council went ahead and adopted comprehensive plan amendments, followed by an illustrative master plan, and we'll be going over these items later, along with the implementing development regulations, which is what the developer is complying with their development proposal. So once those items were adopted by Council, the next thing that was done is, how is the project going to look? This is very important on how things function, how things operate, and the site layout. So in July, a few months later, the City Council adopted the East Gateway Urban Design Guidelines. Those guidelines have actually been codified, so they are part of the code that anyone who comes to that area has to comply with. One of the next steps was in 2010, the city hired a consultant to prepare the engineering plan. What does the engineering plan do? It's very important. It outlines the infrastructure for the area, and this includes water, sewer, utilities, and also the road alignment and surface water. How can that area have a regional detention pond. This is what that document does. So in 2012, this document was finalized. It is available on the city's website, and it's used on a regular basis by not just the property owners, but also the developers in the area. The city ourselves, we've utilized it even. So this brings us to comprehensive plan policies. And for those of you who are new on the council, and those of you who have been around a while, I would like to point out the comprehensive plan. This is a vision document. It's a 20-year plan. All departments use it. It's essentially our marching orders for the community. So when you looked at the CFP, it was consistent with this. The planning department, this is what our zoning codes are based off of. I have selected four policies for the PowerPoint tonight that are very, very applicable for the farm. And with this, I'm just going to go ahead. I wasn't going to read them, but it was suggested that I read them just because it's impactful. So within this sub-area, medium and high-density residential developments is required in the EGOV. High-density residential above retail and or office uses shall be encouraged in the whole EGOV zone. One of the second policies is to create a safe and efficient transportation network. And that is what the engineering study provides, and this is what the developers comply with when they develop in the EGOV area. Also, to create a sustainable neighborhood supported by a diversity of businesses and types of residential development. It's important to note the variety in the word choices that the comprehensive plan outlines. In addition, it says create places that provide for the needs of a diverse population of different ages. That's very important because, as we know, our society is aging and growing on both ends. The third policy is the design of the EGOV should reflect an urban character with a wide mix of uses that generally cater to local residents in the city, but also those in the municipal urban growth area. So to attract people outside of the area to support revenue for the city. The last policy that's been selected is mixed-use buildings with residences or office over first-floor commercial should be encouraged and oriented towards the public realm. And you'll see that later here. So when you look in the comprehensive plan, the illustrative master plan, this is just one concept on how the area can be built out. I'm going to point out a couple things here with the magical pen. So if you look at the text here, you'll see that it takes the zoning code and it actually implements it in this design. It says one-story retail with residential above. You'll see a park. We have a park out there. We have Buffalo Park, one of our highest used parks in the city. It's a completely different design. It's urban in character. It fits the uses and provides play for different age groups, young and old out there. There's the bocce court and other things for older people, not just the young. So you'll see retail with residential, four stories of residential above. So you get the idea. It shows the road connection that connects through from 132nd over to Seattle Hill Road. Just one concept on how the area can be developed. So after the comprehensive plan policies were adopted, the next thing is to do is to write the zoning code ordinances. So the purpose of the EGOV zone district is to actually provide high quality mixed-use neighborhoods with both commercial multifamily uses organized around an internal road network, point blank in the code that implements the comp plan policies. They're dovetailed, tied together. So you can see here the items circled in red. These are the uses, most of the uses, that the developer is proposing in the farm at Mill Creek. They are all principal uses within the zone district. Retail uses, sales, eating, drinking, banks, multifamily, business, professional services, on and on. A parking structure, yes. being proposed. Open spaces, parks, plazas, yes, being proposed. You'll see the road connection through here matches our road alignment. It's slightly different, but it meets all the criteria and our road with standards for the EGOV. So I included the site plan. This is a conceptual plan of what's proposed for the farm. And you can see that there are commercial buildings, and then there's also five-story residential buildings. If you look at the text, you'll see that. And I'm not going to take away from the developer's presentation, so I'll just leave the graphic at this, and they'll explain a little more later on. So approval criteria for the EGOV zone. There are three things that a developer has to comply with in order to have an approved binding site plan in this zone district. This is how they are listed in the code. This is not how they occur. So the first thing that has to happen is a developer has to submit a binding site plan to the city. They have done that, item A. It is approved ultimately by the hearing examiner. And that happens after the development agreement is approved by City Council.
When was the binding site plan submitted?
It was submitted almost a year ago, March 2018, I believe. So they've been in the process for a while. So as part of the hearing examiner approval, they also have to meet the consistency review criteria for the urban design guidelines in consistency with the zoning code. They're all reviewed as part of the staff report, and the hearing examiner looks at that for approval. Those all happen after the development agreement is approved by the City Council. That is why we're here tonight, to provide you this background information so you can move forward with a study session and then ultimately a public hearing on the development agreement. This is not our first development in the EGOV, as you all know, and as the community knows also. Back in 2011, our first one came in the door, and that was Jeff Pratt, his company. The building out there, it's a beautiful building. It's called the Gateway Building. There are still two lots of that development behind the actual building that are not developed yet. Then in 2012, Polygon came along. This is the old Target site. They purchased that. They constructed not just the park, the condos, the apartments, and a two-acre commercial pad.
Can you go back to the master plan map so as you talk about these, you can just point out where they are?
I sure can. And, in fact, I have a specific map, which is my next slide, that you'll probably like better. It's much more accurate. So I'll wrap this up, okay. And then Councilmember Holzclaw, I will flip to that slide.
Thanks.
So in 2015, those 2 acres of the commercial pad, Primrose, the school, daycare, and the dental medical building, that was developed. Then in 2015, also that year was busier. Vintage came along, and this was actually Vintage at Mill Creek. This was their first development. They are a return developer to the city, so this is their second development proposal within the city of Mill Creek. And Vintage is now occupied and also has the senior center. The commercial space down there, they have not leased out yet. They're selecting to withhold that, and the developer can talk about that shortly. Okay, so here is the map that I was referring to. If you start over here on the east side, number one, this is the Polygon area, which was developed with Primrose. The meadows and the towns, the condos, along with the park, you can see here. Then this is Advent Lutheran Church with the community gardens. And then the third one here, this is the Gateway Building. Uppercuts Hair Salon, they've been there forever, even when it was zoned community business in Snohomish County. This area was actually designated strip commercial in Snohomish County in the 80s and 90s. Number four, we touched on that. Number five is Vintage. And number six brings us to the farm at Mill Creek. This is the vacant property currently that is subject matter this evening, the old Buffalo Farm site. Okay. So it was brought up under public comment. Excellent questions. Environmental impacts, proportionate shares. How are these things mitigated? Why is a development allowed? And if they are, what are they doing to offset the impacts of their proposal? Very valid. We have state law for that. It's a requirement for a developer to mitigate impacts on a project. There are 16 different items that are looked at and reviewed. I put the list up here just for informational purposes. This is done under the binding site plan application, and then ultimately the hearing examiner approves the document. So as part of the monetary offset for mitigating impacts, the city requires certain monetary compensation in order to build improvements to offset mitigation impacts. This includes recreation for community parks and neighborhood parks, along with traffic, and then public schools, the Everett School District. We have a separate interlocal agreement with them where the developer is required to pay the school district directly impact fees. These will be gone into a little more detail maybe at the work session, but definitely they are part of the development binding site plan application. So where are we at with the farm at Mill Creek? I mentioned there is a project page out there. We have a couple hundred people signed up on it. This is one of our largest developments since Town Center. So they submitted back in March. That was an excellent question, Councilmember Cavallari. They did that back in March. The completeness letter was issued. This simply says the developer has submitted all the required documents that the city needs in order to review your application. Then we hold a technical review committee meeting with all the outside agencies. The developer is not privy to that meeting. And then we issue a letter out to the developer that states these are the items that need to be corrected in order to be in compliance with city code. Once we're done there, we start negotiation with a draft development agreement. And that's why number 4 is highlighted in red, and that's where we are this evening. We are at the informational session before you have the study session on the DA, just because there has been a change on council over the years, and it's been over 3 years since the DA has been heard. So it's important that we have the information to move forward and make decisions. Once the development agreement has gone through city council, a public hearing is held, and I'm moving forward as if things get approved, obviously, and here we go. Issuance of the SEPA threshold determination about impacts on a project, that's issued by the State Department of Ecology. There's a register for all the projects in the state that are listed. People comment on those. There's a comment period for that. Once that is over, a public hearing is scheduled. We provide a 10-day public notice. It goes out not just to people who are registered on the project website, but also to people within 500 feet of the project site. You'll receive a hard copy in the mail. After the public hearing, he issues a decision. There's a 2-week notice period and comment period. Then the applicant is permitted to go ahead and start the formal design review board process. I would like to point out the applicant, because the project is so large, as you've noticed in your minutes, they have been going to informal design review board meetings with our design review board just to take sections at a time so they can get comments back before they go to formal review. Then at that time, once they receive approval from DRB, they can start with their clearing and grading permits to submit those for engineering review and then building permits. Comprehensive process. At the end of the day, things go well. I would expect this to happen late spring, early summer.
Can you elaborate on the school mitigation process?
I certainly can. Any particular spot you'd like me to start?
Well, it's not the city, as I understand it, that determines the issues with the school capacity. That is, we have an interlocal agreement under our code that basically says, as I understand it, developer, bring us something from the school district that says we have satisfied the school district's requirements for impacts to the school district.
So how this works, and anyone can feel free to step in where you'd like to, we have the interlocal agreement with the school district. They have their own capital facilities plan. Within that plan, they have a breakdown on their projected facilities that they need to have in order to accommodate student growth and population. Now, please keep in mind, there's a lag time between the time a developer pays a fee. They have the time to design and construct those improvements. There's always a lag time. It's like building a road. You can never build to the capacity. And I think that's very important for people to understand that, because that's the reality of our world with traffic and with schools. So the district sets a generation rate for each type of residential unit, whether it's single family, multifamily. They break it down by zero bedroom, a studio apartment, one bedroom, two bedroom, and three bedroom. So for Everett School District, we're assigned a generation amount, a figure like, I'm going to give an example, 0.65 people are generated out of, or students are generated out of a one-bedroom unit. With that fee, the developer is charged $3,000 for that. They are required to pay that once their development is approved. The school district gets that money, then they go through their facilities building process. There's a catch-up time. This is what we deal with as far as our schools being over capacity at this time. It's an issue. And I don't think we have not ever come up with an excellent solution. I would say other states have tried to build over capacity and then buildings sit vacant and then public and people aren't happy with vacant rooms. So, hence we have portables on our schools.
I just want to make sure everyone understands that neither the staff nor the hearing examiner nor us, as long as the developer brings us the agreement signed with the school district saying they've satisfied the district's mitigation requirements, the city does not have any authority over the development on that issue.
That is correct. I would like to point out that the proposal, as you saw back on the list here, due to the amounts of units and type of development, they have a significant amount of impact fees that are due for the proposal. $1 million, $1 million, $500,000.
Put that in perspective, I think Polygon's fee was about $330,000, and the years you had up there weren't the years they were built. I believe those were the years they were approved.
Correct.
So the construction was a couple years later, but I'm pretty sure Polygon paid $330,000, $350,000 for their impact for, I forget how many units are out there. I think it's an equivalent.
302, and then 2 acres of commercial.
So the district's impact fees have gone up. This year they went up for single family from, I think, 7,000 a unit to just under 16,000.
There is a significant increase.
Housing that's proposed here, is there a reduced tax rate that the city collects going forward?
So my understanding, based on the program that the developer has selected for his financing, is that they are not exempt from property tax. And that would be an excellent question for the developer to follow up with when he has his presentation with you. Correct.
So how does the city, since there's no doubt about the traffic, grab more cars? I mean, I go to work on 128 every day. I come home that way.
Yes.
So can we tell, that's $1.1 million, but what is it the city is going to do with that money to mitigate the traffic?
Our capital facilities improvement plan, and those dollars need to be used for projects that these areas impact. And so we have a list of those in our CFP. And they'll be used for construction improvements to make that area better for traffic flow. I would like to point out that in the traffic report, if you go read it, they are within the threshold of the level of service that the city's adopted. They need it. like Seattle, we have a low area. We acknowledge that there's bad traffic, and they fall within the level of service requirement that our comprehensive plan and city council has adopted. Yes?
The traffic fee, is that just the cities, or is that
this was the cities?
So there's going to be an additional impact fee, would there not, for the county, because it sits right on the across the street at unincorporated Snohomish County?
This particular proposal was vested prior to the execution of our new agreement with Snohomish County. Certainly. Yes.
Perhaps incorporate the cost of the spine road with that as well. That would be necessary going forward.
Thank you. And that is a comprehensive plan policy also to have the connection of the road. It does alleviate traffic because both lights are signalized where it comes out through the East Gateway area. That is correct.
So the spine road is accessed on both sides by
yes. That's the 132nd
signal.
Yes.
It's not.
I thought originally the spine road was being impacted by 35th to help alleviate the traffic.
The spine road actually will go ahead and change this. So the spine road comes here at 39th, comes through all the way through. We have a controlled WashDOT access management plan with WashDOT. So there are two intersections that were approved back in, I think, 2007 with WashDOT, down here at 44th, here at 39th. Currently, the road stops right here before the Dunn property, I believe. Yes, it's about right here is where it ends. So when you pass the park, you will see the sign that says Future Road Connection. So currently it does not go out to Seattle Hill Road. It terminates there. So until those properties are developed or until the city makes a decision if they choose to acquire the property, move forward to extend the road ends here. So obviously connection of the roadway with these two signalized lights would provide a good solution for traffic flow, safe traffic flow in and out of the area. Does that answer your question?
So how much of the spine road is the developer paying for?
Everything on their part. So here, the intersection improvements all the way here to the end of their property. So when you look at this, they're paying for... This is the public road. I highlighted the public road. Everything else is private. There's public access easements over the parks and trails, obviously, but the road portion, the developer pays for.
Okay, so at one point, the road was supposed to cost $12 million.
Yes.
A lot of that includes the eastern portion.
Yes.
So what is the cost of the...
His portion? The developer's paying 100% of his costs. In addition, he has traffic impact fees. What that cost is, I do not know. That would be a good question for the developer to respond to.
Okay.
And it might change in 6 months, concrete costs, but... So with that, unless there's any questions from council... And if there's more later, I'd be glad to answer them. I'm going to turn it over to the developer. We have Ryan Patterson with Eastgate Advantage. And then we also have Chris Olson with Olson Architects. And I'm going to go ahead and pull up their PowerPoint presentation that they have. I'll minimize this in case you need it. Yeah, maybe. Let's see. Okay.
While they're pulling this up, my name is Ryan Patterson. I'm the developer, and I'm with Vintage Housing. But I want to make this fundamentally better for everybody. I was thinking that I'd have the architect guide us through the project and kind of give us a scope of what was happening, and then I get into the details of just what our company is doing and why it was designed this way. Does that make sense from a presentation standpoint, or would you rather I went into the economic benefits? Or I'll leave it to you then.
All right. Do I do, for the record, do I state my name, address, everything on this?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. I'm just
introduce yourself.
DRB, I do that every time.
I'm going to maximize this.
Chris Olson, 3624 South Manitoba Boulevard, Spokane, Washington. Now I can get this. We saw how much hard time you have. That's all right. I've been here quite a few times. Usually I just talk louder to the DRB board here. Stay there. There we go. Okay. Everybody hear me now? So I'm just going to do, kind of like Brian said, a brief introduction of the project, walk you through the site plan, show you some of the mixed-use structures and some of the buildings we have here. To date, we have been to two design review meetings with informally, walked through the residential buildings, the streetscapes. We're working through the single-story retail buildings out front. And we're coming back, actually this week we'll be here Thursday to talk about the site, the gateways, the entrances, and some of the plazas. So starting at, got the cursor. Christy, how did you put the cursor up here? Yeah, there we go, gotcha. All right, so entering the project on 132nd, the yellow buildings here on the site are single-story pad retail. Ryan knows more of who the users are. They're kind of fluctuating at this point, but it's my understanding we have restaurants, charter school, service-based retail, and I think other food service here in Building B. There's surface parking. This larger lot in the middle is it's called a plaza street. So we were going to do a pedestrian-type plaza street like you have in Town Center here. However, ballarding that off caused access issues, so we moved that into the internal part of the site so we can ballard this off and create more of a festival atmosphere there. Coming into the site, we have Building D, which is this smaller mixed-use building here. There's 32 dwelling units in that building, a rear plaza that's overlooking the wetland. Moving up the street, Building E is a longer mixed-use building with all grade-level retail, a subterranean parking level, and then four levels of apartments above as well. There's 100 units in that building. To the rear of that is parking screened with single-story garages and a retaining wall, along with a pathway that takes you along the south edge of the property and then connects you to the wetland. And then there's a mitigation portion to the south, which is in a further slide. Building F is also a five-story mixed-use building with commercial and live-work commercial on the main level, with dwelling units on the upper four floors, 222 dwelling units, with a parking structure in the middle of that building, shielded from public view, facing 41st.
And 41st is an internal street, and it only faces the village of Mill Creek, so that no one will see any of the parking garage the way that it's designed.
And 41st is actually constructed now from phase one. Going back to Christy, the main drag comes in here, down, around the corner, up and connects up to phase one, and then back out to 41st. And it goes to this east edge of phase one and terminates there, and then the connection needs to be made further down. So this slide shows some of the wetland mitigation is taking place. So on site, we're working through the buffer zone here. There's retainings, lookout, a small park area here, and then there's a connection point that runs to the south to a 60-acre wetland park that's being rehabbed and done with a small parking area for people to visit. You can notice up here in the corner, you can kind of see the size of our site. It's pretty little compared to this large wetland area that they're redeveloping. So I'm just going to take you through some of the structures on the site. Just going to get you familiar with it. Like Christy had said, we'll be back a few times here, so it takes a few meetings to actually kind of start to wrap your head around what's going on with the project. This is Building D. So mixed use, grocery use on the corner here, four stories of apartments above. West side of this building faces the wetland. This is Building E, looking up the spine road connection. Again, brick base, tall windows, retail. The living units are above. This building's broken into, it's a 600-foot long building. It's broken into three buildings in the mass. There's a cut right here in the middle and a cut at the other third. Middle of the building connects up with building F, which you'll see in just a moment. And that's where the main amenities and tenants arrive at the building. That's building F. Again, same spine road here. This drops you down into that Festival Street area. This building has more commercial office on the main floor, along with the entry leasing office and amenity for the residential users, as well as a internal pathway back to the parking garage, which is for residents. This is 132nd view of building F. So adjacent to this would be smaller commercial live-work units, four stories of residential, and then a connection down to the single-story pad retail. The single-story pad retail is not being overlooked at this time. It's just we're in the middle of design review, so we haven't settled on what it is yet. We're working through materials, so I didn't want to start showing you a bunch of stuff that's going to continue to change, but the residential buildings have been vetted a few times with the review board. Parking structure off of 41st. This is where most tenants will park in the parking structure here. It's secured, gated off. Stair, kind of at an entry point there, and then there's a plazas between the buildings for the tenants to use between building F and the garage. This is a shot of some of the grade level retail along building E. When you go out there, if you look at the site, there's about 20 feet of grade from east to west, slopes down the hill to the wetland. So we had to come in and kind of step our retail up the hill. So you'll see a lot of raised planters, stairs, ramps for accessibility, etc. So there's a lot of variation happening along the street, and we worked real hard to make sure that it wasn't just little steps and rails and stuff sticking out. Not that Town Center is a bad example here, but there's a handful of examples where you have like a step with just a handrail into the sidewalk. We tried to mitigate that by doing planters and other landscape features and benches to try to hide that so that you're not just tripping over a step here and there. They vary from 13 feet at the lowest point to about 18 feet at the highest point on the taller zones.
And what were the amenities you kept talking about? You said this is where all the amenities
are. So typical amenities in these buildings would be office, multi-purpose room, theater, gym,
media center,
lounge. And then there's also external recreation in the plaza behind building F and also adjacent to building E, along with the external or the trail network. And there's a couple other small plaza areas within the site people can gather as well. So building F looking up the spine road as well, again, just kind of illustrating the grade change, the planters, the steps, small benches, et cetera. These are going to be, like I said, more of an office, a medical type use, something like that would be here. This would be the alleyway between the garage and the live, work, and residential units. The garage does connect to the residential buildings with bridges on every level, so tenants don't have to come down through the garage, through the building, back up into the building. And really trying to promote pedestrian access and circulation through the site, and giving everybody kind of smaller park, kind of pocket plazas and small seating areas around. The live work are set up to have their own private decks and small stoops next to you, seeing the steps and small seating areas adjacent. And that's it for those buildings. And then that's kind of the overview of what this thing's beginning to look like. And then Ryan gets to answer all the hard questions.
Thanks, Chris.
So you can just flip up and down and I'll just go.
We'll figure that out. Thanks. Thank you again for your time today, Council, everyone from the town. Give me an opportunity to express, you know, to show our project and hopefully address a lot of the concerns and questions that everyone has. My name is Ryan Patterson. I'm with Vintage Housing. Vintage has been developing in the state of Washington for over 20 years. We currently have 24 other projects. We've owned and operated, and we've never sold anything. We've been longtime community partners. And we've also a community partner to the city of Mill Creek. We developed the first phase, or what we continue to refer to as phase one, which is the Vintage at Mill Creek, which was 120 senior housing, active senior housing units, in which we provided a senior center at no cost to the city. And I think they're operating very happily right now currently. So when we started developing on that project, we found the opportunity to develop this next phase, or what we're calling phase two, which is the farm. And the farm is composed of two different components, really, which is, we've discussed, it's the retail and the residential pieces. The retail is currently now actually over 100,000 square feet of retail. When I originally conceived it, it was about 78,000. The inline retail, which is under buildings, making up one part of that, and then the shops, which is the freestanding retail component, was about 38,000 feet. The reason that we haven't shown as much of that component right now is just because we're currently working with the different retail tenants to design their buildings. The idea, though, is that we're going to have an organic grocer that we've already signed an LOI with, a high-end steakhouse, a bistro, wine shops, advanced medical office buildings, some commercial space for, you know, brokers, commercial uses, banks, so forth. And then we also have a charter school that we're looking to. All of this is built around to function with the multifamily pieces, the residential pieces. The synergy between those is truly a really advanced mixed-use project, which, you know, I know a lot of people claim to have that, but we're supposed to bring residents in. They're supposed to function and work with all of the various components of both the living and the working and staying there on site to help some of the traffic issues. And also the Spinet Road should hopefully, you know, mitigate that by bringing people into the site instead of waiting and lining up outside. Yes. Well, there's a reason for the empty storefronts, actually. We have chosen not to. We found that our tenant base is actually a lot more active than we thought, and so parking's been an issue there. So we've decided to mitigate that by increasing the parking while we are developing the second phase. In the second phase, we've set aside additional parking to handle from the first phase, so we can increase that parking and work together. We have over 1,100, we have almost 1,200 spaces in the second phase, and that'll help alleviate some of that. And then we've had plenty of interest in the commercial. But the other part of this, and we've developed other mixed use, to be honest with you, in other parts that have not been successful. This is designed correctly. This is designed to bring people on site. It's designed with the right level of parking. It's designed with the right level of synergy between the multifamily, or the, you know, the number of units and the actual commercial pieces. A lot of people say they're fixed use. They throw, you know, 2,000-3,000 feet down below, 6,000 feet. It's not functional, right? The shops can't stay open. They can't work this way. This has the right connective pieces with the density that's around it. That's why the EGOV was actually created. I mean, if you look at the way that the zoning was created, it was to create that kind of, you know, mix between enough residential and enough uses that people would connect to it. So we feel very strongly we're getting a lot of interest, well over what we anticipated. Hopefully that addressed your question. In addition to the planned open spaces, which are already existing in the site, the trails, I think Chris touched on, we went ahead and acquired a 61-acre site, which was formerly known as the Natural Nines Holdings. It's currently a wetland that is damaged and needs a lot of work. We've undertaken that to make that a wetland park with trails, learning center, additional parking off-site. So the idea is to connect that to our project. So not only are we building, you know, developing 12 acres here, we're redeveloping that wetland, and we're redeveloping 61 acres, all to the benefit of the city.
Can you pull up that map again, just so we can see where that is in reference to the project site?
What's that?
That's what I thought,
right? Yeah, so this is the whole Pacific Topsoil site? Correct. So we acquired that February, actually. Just at the beginning of this month, as part of our development and with the city and working with the city.
So, can you point out where Pacific Topsoils has got their bark and recycling facility now, or something like that?
If you see where Pacific Topsoils is right there at the top of the, that would be, yep, up, yeah. I can't expand that. I'm not as technically proficient, but if somebody wants to. So, you know, that's just touching on some of the benefit, the secondary benefits. I know, when I was talking to staff, there was a lot of questions from the community about what the direct economic benefits of the project are going to be, besides the impact fees that we're paying in order to mitigate some of the things that we're doing. We're also providing, I think, strong economic tax incentive by bringing in retail and by bringing in property taxes. That those numbers look to be in around $500,000 a year. The sales that we anticipate to generate are about $22 million in retail sales, of which your component of $22 million is about $191,000 annually. We actually think that's low because that was based on a study that we did on behalf of the city and shared, but we are actually increasing the amount of retail that we have in the project by another 20,000 feet, so then we think that number will come up substantially. The property taxes are anticipated to be a little over $200,000 a year, incremental to the city of the portion. I know there was a question about the financing that we're using, and that that financing is state bonds issued that are but do not have a tax abatement associated with them. That is by statute and has nothing to do with the bond financing. In addition to the No, I mean, it's all based on valuation, the same model. So whatever our assessed value is will be the property taxes that get paid. In addition to the annual revenues from both sales taxes and property taxes, the project cost itself is $120 million, which generates about $600,000 to $700,000 of taxes from just the construction as well as jobs and high-paying jobs during the construction phase. I think lastly, you know, I can continue to kind of go through the economic benefits or we can answer questions. The last was in regard to the either municipal or fire, or I'm sorry, the police substation. That has not gone away. We've offered to work with the city. We think it's important. Crime is something that's very serious to us. Again, being in the state for 20 years, developing the way we have a significant property management experience. We know how to mitigate these issues. And one of the best ways to mitigation is have a great relationship with the police force. So we're offering that space at no cost to the city with the build-out that we've discussed. How that's, you know, ultimately that gets worked out in the development agreement, but that's a component of what we're offering. So the senior center, the police substation, the wetland parks, the idea is to create a transformative, right, development that fits in the guidelines that was set before us. And we're excited to talk about it and to do what we're doing. I open up for any questions from the city, please.
Thank you for your presentation and for recognizing that there was some parking issues at the existing project.
Yeah, I apologize for that. I had no idea that we'd have the car box that we have.
We set the regulation as far as the number, and then you comply with it. But what we didn't anticipate was the pay-to-use spots. So some folks said, hey, you can pay and you can have your own spot. And they're opting out of that and then parking in a public spot. There's a fix to that.
Well, actually, the pay got instituted because everyone started bringing cars, and so that we were trying to have some of the people who don't need cars anymore to go away from that. So the pay was to drive people from having cars on the site, and the commercial spaces are to be mitigated and monitored regardless. So that was the idea behind the pay. The pay did not start that way, as a matter of fact.
I'm just saying that's contributed to the problem as some of the parking issues, according to the folks that have been using the senior center. Barbara, I don't see her out there, but I've been chatting with her about it.
We talk to the senior center often, and obviously I work with Brooke very, very closely. I think one of the best ways that we can mitigate is we've added some spots. We're going to add some spots into the phase two, and in the interim piece, we're actually going to take down that old barn and hopefully use that slab as additional parking.
So in the new project, are the parkings like the garage? Are you going to have to pay to use that, or is that going to be part of your part of that?
You will have a pay component if you want a secondary car. I'm trying to reduce parking. The idea is to stop having people. You want to use transit. You want to use other things. You want to get people off the roads. These are how we're going to have to do it. It is a nice fantasy, but I mean, we definitely want to try to mitigate the number of cars if we can. But none of the commercial parking, none of the parking in that area, again, will be monitored. But there's more than enough here. We're actually overparked. We have extra 200 spaces just for tenant resident guests.
I hope so. Because yeah. I know that I want your project to thrive. I want the businesses to have. And I've had people say they've come into town center to go to Azul, done a couple laps, and went, I'm going somewhere else. Right. I can't park. You know, if you've got somebody –
that maybe can't get a disabled spot or has a hiccup, doesn't have a placard, but, you know, doesn't want to walk up two blocks, mm-hmm. and they're just going to go somewhere else if parking. And, again, I take some responsibility for that because those parking ordinances, we do. But if we set the rules for that. But I would do it differently today knowing what I know now. And so I'm worried about parking.
And it's definitely a concern for us, but I think that we've more than mitigated in this phase. And the first phase, again, was based off what our experience were in, call it adult active or senior-level housing. And we have more active adults in this particular development and who had more cars than normal. So that's kind of generated that. That is not what's going to happen in phase two. And, in fact, we have 37 extra spots that we've created at no cost to the first phase to help offset that issue.
Yeah, I've got a few questions. And the first one, I'm not sure if it's for Ryan, Gina, or Christy. Could you just educate the council and the public on what the requirements were for the traffic study? Because I assume it's not just looking at this project itself. It's looking at the bigger picture of future traffic as well. Can you elaborate on what was looked at?
I'll do my best, and then you guys can take over. So a traffic study is composed of, so we hire someone to go out, and they monitor what the existing issues are and traffic flows are on the roads that are in and around the site. And then they measure through, you know, having calculated how many trips, daily trips, or what they call, you know, average daily trips that a project of our size or scope would generate, i.e. if you have a one-bedroom unit, a two-bedroom unit, or a three-bedroom unit, that has all designated a number of trips, right? They've calculated this over time. And if you have retail of different components, it generates a number of trips. And so then they add all of that together, they see what the impact would be on the roads around it, and that's how they determine whether or not we are going to, you know, how we're going to change the traffic plan and what would need to and what we would need to do to offset that. But I look to staff if I missed it. So this has been studied in depth. We provided this. It was provided by Transpo Group as a well-known transportation consultant, you know, validated by multiple different studies.
Gina, could you touch upon the, I hate to call it signal optimization because I'm not sure it's optimal yet, but part of the regional funding was for signal optimization on 128th, particularly west of I-5. And I know, what is the status of that? Has that been implemented?
So is this regarding the adaptive signals?
Yes, I'm sorry, the adaptive. That's what I was...
Okay, so there's two phases to the adaptive signals. One, they're both in preparations for BRT, for bus rapid transit. And this is not a... this is a project that expands beyond the city of Mill Creek. There's multiple jurisdictions and is spearheaded by Snohomish County. Both of them, I believe, have federal funding. The first adaptive signals is in preparation for BRT Green, which is going to go live next month. That's adaptive one. So it follows the same alignment as BRT. And then adaptive signals two is in preparation for the orange line. So within the city of Mill Creek, it would follow the 164th alignment and then SR 527.
But that first phase, once it's implemented, hopefully it's going to help address some of the issue we've heard, because the timing of the lights west of I-5 is ridiculous.
Right.
But that's what it's intended to get to. It hasn't been implemented yet.
I am not exactly sure where that is at. I can find out from Snohomish County.
Excuse me. Ryan, are you able to utilize LI low-impact development on this site?
In terms of water usage and...
handling the stormwater for the project.
We approached it several different ways, but yes, I mean, we're going to be conforming with low impact.
And then the other question I had, could you talk about what your, I mean, there's been a lot of discussion in the public about the prospective tenants you're targeting. Can you talk about that and the work, what is meant by workforce housing? And one related question to that is, just so I'm clear, I saw numbers that said 355 units, and then it said 25 or 26 work living. Is that within the 350, or is that in addition to?
No, that's within the number. The 356 units, that's total number of apartment dwellings. So we're utilizing a specific type of financing which limits our ability to charge rent or to have tenants that exceed a certain rental income or area median income. Our particular niche is the 60%, which we call workforce housing. These are people. I mean, I can give you the numbers. A three-bedroom household would be $57,000. A four-bedroom would be $65,000. We're not talking about people who have no money. I mean, we're not targeting people who, you know, are coming out of programs and are dragging on society. I mean, and concern. And I hate to use that word. I'm sorry. But, I mean, talking about people who are working in our communities. We're trying to provide them an amazing place to live that's comprehensive or in comparable to anything else that would be rentable. That's the tenant base that we're targeting. Those are the people that we think that we want in our communities, and that's the communities that we've been building. We have another significant project down in White Center. White Center is very excited about what we've done. We're regentrifying down between 112th and 114th. I welcome you guys to go online and look at it or to go down. It's called Southside of Seattle. It's a phenomenal project. It was designed by the same architects firm. It's five stories over retail, around parking. It'll give you a really good conceptual idea of what we're trying to do here as well. We're not, and again, we're community partners. We're trying to bring people and tenants that are going to fit to the profile that Mill Creek wants.
Go ahead for now.
Councilmember Cavallari.
Thanks, Mayor. There's been some discussion here regarding the Spine Road and the costs associated with it. I've heard anywhere from $7.5 million to $12 million. Who's going to pay for that? This is kind of the nutshell question.
Well, I believe that the number between $7.5 and $12 million would be the total Spine Road, right, coming through the whole project and connecting 132nd all the way down. Yeah. So, I mean, I actually was trying to figure out, well, I was trying to jot down and figure out if I could give you an idea of what our portion of that, but, I mean, I think we're about a quarter of the site, so whatever that is, I mean, we're bearing the burden of that, and I can get you better numbers on that to follow. But we're not asking the city to pay any of that. We're putting that infrastructure in, including the signalization off 132nd and all the way through. There's, just the one piece at the Rim-Kim property that, I don't know what that's going to take to get that acquired or eminent domain or whatever that is, but, I mean, that's something for the city to decide. We're absolutely partners with you guys, and I've approached them to try to buy that site, to be honest with you. I mean, we feel strongly that that connectivity would be a game changer for the project.
The question we're asking is how many dollars. The reality is what the developer can do, he can build it to our standards for a way different price than we can build it. So the $8 million is what it costs the city. We might have to let those. We have some LF funding, but they're still out there, but they're tougher to get. But the reality is, it'd be embarrassing to know what he can get it done for versus what we can do for it.
Well, I'm sure in your number two that included buying the land. There must be some land component, right? Where because you have the development standards on us, we're dedicating the land to the city once we've completed all the infrastructure.
I think the important thing is he's going to build it to our standards, to our plan, to our connectivity, up to as far as he can own. But he points out there's a few segments that are not going to get completed by the church or the Rim-Kim property or other pieces, and that's where the city may have to go back and say, how do we finish those pieces? Either wait for those sites to develop on their own or go back and eminent domain or decide to make a deal with those people, can we cut across your property? So that's the nut for us, is to correct.
And I welcome you guys to go see phase one, which gives you a good example of how that street frontage looks.
Thank you, Councilmember
Bond. Ms. Decker? So the term live-work unit, I think I know what you mean by that, but instead of assuming, could you just explain that?
On the ground floor, away from where commercial would be viable, because that was a good question, we created a live-work where people might be, you know, their own home studio or that. So it's a big open, almost loft-like, with primary space that is used for working and only a small section of living space, like a kitchen and bathroom in the back. The majority of that space is, you know, fronted and has a commercial look on the frontage, and again goes to, you know, either, you know, people who are consultants or people who want to have their own painting shop, workshop, metal shop. Does that make sense? So it's a loft-like unit, 12 to 14. Chris, I want to say 14, 15 foot high, clear, and it's got store frontage glass.
It's quite different from other type of multifamily type dwellings. So I don't know if you can answer this question, but a lot of us are concerned about the impact on our fire and police.
Mm-hmm.
There's an average call volume associated with different types of housing developments,
mm-hmm.
depending upon their affordability and yes. support and that type of thing.
With workforce housing, is there any numbers that you are familiar with as the call volume is 50% of what a typical
subsidized housing development would be? That's a top of my head, because we're targeting the upper end range of what you are studying, you know, there's probably a diminishment of that call number, but I could get that information for you.
That would be helpful.
Yeah. So ultimately it comes down to property management. I mean, it's who you let in and the tenant, and just because someone's here, you have to monitor your tenants, and you have criteria, and we have the same criteria in terms of, you know, we want people who are going to take care of our buildings and who are going to be there, and so we try to monitor that as close as we can. I believe pride of ownership, but I mean, it's really hard to buy a house in Mill Creek if you make $65,000 a year, right? I mean, your average home price is significantly higher than even the area around us. So, yeah, I will try to put that together for you.
You referenced that you're close to 100,000 square feet of retail now, as opposed to mid-70s.
Correct.
Where is that on the site plan? Where is the additional retail?
All the underbuilding, including and also the 38,000 square feet of standalone.
Okay.
I don't know how the calculations, but I can bug Chris for them and send them on to you if you'd like, so you can see where everything's located.
Yeah, is it broke down somewhere of what's in the standalone buildings and what's the retail under the residential? Is it? Some of the writing on some of the printouts is a little bit small. Yeah, and it's not helping.
There's about 37,500 in the pad retail, so the building C, B, A, A3, and A4, and then the remainder is underneath buildings D, E, and F. So, right, the calculation before had... So the live work is part of that calculation, is for the commercial. So where it was 70 before, there's about 21,000 feet of commercial live work space as well. So we didn't grow the project by 30,000. It's just the way it's attributed to the site for parking and other things. So I guess, did that answer your question? Yeah, were you asking like why it grew from 70 to 100?
Yeah, I was just trying to figure out where, because the site plan, I didn't see it change significantly, so I was just trying
no,
to...
No, it didn't. It's where how the building's programmed out. So at some points, there was other things going on in the main level. So once we finally settled out where the medical, where the amenities, the lease-up was going, the different pad, and then the other, like building E where we have the cut-throughs and stuff, it all shook out to where it actually got netted more commercial space.
Okay. I think the city manager forwarded to us at the end of last week your Integra report, which I think was just over 2 years ago. Between now and next week, would you be able to do a quick update to the summary of that? Because I think it was based on back in the days when we were below 10% for a tax rate, and it assumed mid-70s commercial. I'd be interested in just seeing a quick update on the numbers of what it looks like with what you're proposing now.
I'll see if I can get that done before the development.
elsewhere. It kind of creeps me out a little bit.
The wrap building is not something that's been done a lot of. It's done in Southern California quite a bit, and it's very successful there. We're entering a new part of the market in the Pacific Northwest for this. But again, I think this is going to end up being more consultants and people not true shop space, but you know, people looking to work out of their homes.
We're starting that now, and we'll be able to bring that back to you at the same time that we discuss the development agreement.
Okay, and I'd like to see the one-time revenues separated from the ongoing, for instance, there's going to be one-time sales tax on buildings, there's going to be one-time litigation fees.
Right, their 2016 report identified both ongoing as well as one-time sales tax construction fees.
I think more after the reports get updated for Mr. Holtzclaw.
I'd like to know what the expenses are to go along with that. We talked about it prior to that. I'd like to see the numbers. Okay, well, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for your time. Thank you.
Thanks.
If you want to follow them out and ask questions, if they're amenable, if you have questions, I would suggest you submit them online or submit them to staff. But as we said at the beginning, we have the audience communication.
We've got the rest of our meeting. We'll do audience communication one more time. And so that's tonight, or we'll have...
It's unfortunate we require to ask our questions until we have any information to ask in a public forum. So that others would understand our questions as well.
We have audience communication as soon as we're done with the rest of the meeting. You're welcome to another 3 minutes and or submit your questions in writing, because this is the first time we've seen this also. So.
And Mayor, I just wanted to remind council as well as those in the audience that there is an open house tomorrow that the developer is scheduled between 5 and 7 p.m.
And they'll have staff there ready to answer your questions, and that's up at Vintage?
Yeah, that's at Senior Center. That's correct.
Where we just learned there's more parking.
Good.
We'll
have the answers, or we're going to tell us about the surface.
I have no idea, but I certainly hope whatever questions you have, they're the people to ask. And like I said, there's going to be several more times we're not through, and we've got time to ask questions. So next up is the AWC Center for Quality Communities Scholarship nominee, and that would be Mike. This is your...
Councilmember Todd and myself met the AWC Center for Quality Communities, which promotes leadership, has put together an annual scholarship of $1,000. Cities are allowed to select their own nominees. We put the word out, and we received over 12 nominees from local students, the most we've ever received, and they are an incredible list of individuals. We did finally select one individual, and so today we ask a motion to select Elijah Beals. He is a resident of Springtree, but actually goes to Glacier Peak in high school. To represent the City of Mill Creek in a statewide AWC Center for Quality Communication scholarship selection process. He will also receive, if so approved, a $500 monetary award from the City of Mill Creek as our recognition for him being a nominee. Thank you.
We have a motion and a second, and the name was?
Elijah Beals.
Just so everyone knows, his father is the pastor of Canyon Creek Church, which is the sponsor of Trunk or Treat.
Oh, you didn't know that.
I know that. Incredible.
I think it's focused on kids who've done kids, young people who have done amazing things. You get either in their school or in the community, and Eastwood Head and Shoulders. I would get some great applications this year, but Eastwood Head and Shoulders among some others, and he's the kind of future leader we like to have in our communities. It's great.
This fellowship is solely, really focused on leadership abilities, and Elijah's essay was impressive, to say the least, of what he did to help lead his community and his fellow students. So, tremendous young man. Good nominee.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Passes unanimously. And next up is the ordinance amending the Mill Creek Municipal Code related to code.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. I'd like to introduce Sherry Ringstad, Associate Planner, who's going to be providing the presentation on this matter tonight.
Good evening, Council. I'm going to see if I can find my presentation. There we go. Thank you. As Bob Stowe said, my name is Sherry Ringstad. I'm an associate planner with the Development Services Division. And it's my pleasure this evening to present to you proposed code amendments that are amending the code related to code enforcement. I'd like to start with a little bit of background. Almost 2 years ago, we transitioned enforcement of the land use code. It used to be with the community services officer in the police department, and we transitioned to development services. And at that time, we kind of took a look at the process and how it was working, and we made some changes. It was first contact with the property owner was a regulatory order, which is a legal sized piece of paper, lots of fine print and legal language. Not super friendly, and to be honest, we weren't having a lot of success with that approach. So we changed it, and we kind of approached it from more of an educational perspective. We start out with a straightforward, plain English language letter, letting them know that they're not in compliance with the code. Like, for example, you know, you may not be aware, but the code does prohibit storage of RVs in a front yard setback. And then we talk about how they can bring their property into compliance. For example, you have an option of storing that RV in your side or rear yard if it's screened, or you can store it off-site. And then we usually set a date for compliance. And then we talk about consequences if they aren't in compliance by that date. And the consequences would be proceeding with the code enforcement with the regulatory order and the civil fines. And then we end with an invitation encouraging them to call so we can talk about their particular situation. And we've had a lot of success with this approach. As a matter of fact, when it transitioned to our department, there were somewhere between 20 and 30 unresolved code enforcement cases. And right now we only have one. And that's sort of a more difficult case. It's been around for a while. We've been working on it for a while. But there's actually some movement on that one. So there's some hope for that. But we are really proud of the success that we've had. And when we started enforcing the code, we did find that there were certain aspects of it that were a little bit hard to enforce. And that's the purpose of the amendments this evening, to clarify the code and also make it easier to enforce. And I'd just like to note that the city attorney has reviewed these proposed amendments, and the Planning Commission has also reviewed them. They reviewed them in study session first, and then in November they held a public hearing to review them and take public comment. And in addition to our typical avenues of getting the word about a public hearing out, code amendments aren't super exciting. We don't typically have a lot of people come for those public hearings. But we do have some people that were more frequent reporters of code enforcement, shall we say. So we invited them personally to come. We sent them the proposed code enforcement amendments, and they didn't actually come to the hearing. So we're going to assume that they were okay with what we were proposing. And at that public hearing, the Planning Commission did adopt Resolution 2018-165, recommending these proposed amendments to the City Council. And the way I structured the staff report, kind of in sections, the first section was just a discussion of the issue that we were trying to resolve. The second was our approach, how we were going to go about resolving it. And then the third was the proposed language itself. So I've structured the PowerPoint in the same fashion. I'd like to start with issue number one. The code currently prohibits inoperable vehicles from being stored in a driveway or front yard setback. And the problem came in with the definition of inoperable vehicle. Our current definition said a vehicle that, because of disrepair or lack of licensing, is incapable or prevented by law from being propelled on a public highway. Well, we didn't really think the intent of the code was to enforce vehicle tabs. The intent of the land use code was to keep derelict vehicles out of a driveway. And the police department has other means to make sure that the tabs are up to date. So what we're proposing is to actually take out the word inoperable vehicle and replace it with the term junk vehicle, because we really felt that's exactly what the code was trying to get at. And just not having a current tab, we actually ran into a number of cases. There's some pretty valid reasons why someone may not have current tabs on their car. Just, for example, a couple, someone was deployed in the military, and, you know, they fully intended to get it licensed when they got back. But until they got back, they wouldn't be driving it, and so, therefore, it was technically considered an inoperable vehicle just because of the tabs. We also had a grandfather who was saving his pickup truck for his grandson, who was 15, wouldn't be 16 till the next year. They weren't going to be driving it. So he didn't want to license it until he gave it to his grandson. So there's a number of valid reasons why just using tabs is not necessarily a good idea. And in this section, we also wanted to add an exception, because we have come up with people who have, say, an RV, and they want to park it in their driveway to load it and clean it and get it ready for a trip. Or I had a gentleman who's wanted to clean his boat off. He had off-site storage for the boat, but the off-site storage didn't provide washing facilities, so he wanted to clean the boat up before he took it back. So we're just proposing to add an exception that RVs and boats, for purposes of loading or cleaning, can be parked in the front yard setback for a period of 72 hours. Now, this is the proposed code language itself. 1722.080b, no recreation vehicle, boat, trailer, or, this is where we'd be striking the word inoperable, junk vehicle shall be parked or stored in any front yard or front yard setback area, including the driveway. Exception, recreational vehicles and boats may be temporarily parked in the front yard setback area for purposes of cleaning or loading for a period not to exceed 72 hours. Okay, and this is, we are also proposing a definition for junk vehicle. We took this definition out of the RCWs. It's not necessarily a perfect definition. Planning Commission discussed it at length, went back and forward about it, and in the end decided that since it was an exact match for the RCWs, to go ahead and adopt it as is. And basically what it says is a junk vehicle means a vehicle certified under RCW 46.55.230 as meeting at least three of the following requirements, is 3 years old or older, is extensively damaged, such damage including but not limited to any of the following, a broken window or windshield, or missing wheels, tires, motor, or transmission, is apparently inoperable, has an approximate fair market value equal only to the approximate value of the scrap in it. And All they need to do is meet three of these, and it really shouldn't be an issue for a derelict vehicle to be able to tick at least three of those boxes.
Well, why 3 years?
I'm sorry?
Well, the three-year criteria.
Well, like I said, this did come out of the RCWs, and Planning Commission did go around about it, and that was one of their questions. But I think the point is they just have to meet at least three. Another one the Planning Commission had a little bit of an issue with was the fair market value. How do you decide what fair market value is? But I think the fact that they just have to meet three. And like I said, it's not a perfect definition, but because it is in the RCWs, they decided to go with that language.
So I think the car is inoperable
uh-huh.
and has a broken windshield. It wouldn't, and that was it. It wouldn't qualify as junk.
Well, potentially not, but how many cars less than 3 years old are, I mean, unless they've been in an accident or something. But then if they were that bad off, then they'd probably meet that, the criteria about the fair market value. Yeah, like I said, it really isn't a perfect definition, but it's better than the inoperable vehicle and the expired tabs, which is what we were trying to correct.
Sure, the
yes.
Bottom one has an appropriate fair market value equal only to the approximate value of the scrap in, and I really don't agree with that because mm-hmm.
Are you proposing to change?
So right there it says has an approximate fair market value
yes.
equal only to the approximate value of the scrap bin.
Okay.
So basically it's worth $75 if it's in there, according to that line. But the scrap in it, correct?
Well, I think that the scrap in it.
No, that's you're misinterpreting. That's not what
yeah.
I'm saying.
Thank you, Mark.
That this vehicle's metal is worth $75 and that's all this thing is worth. If the car is worth $2,000, then it's worth more than its scrap.
Hey, well, I can say I didn't write this language. That's all I can tell you.
I have a question.
Yes.
So one, I appreciate this very much. I deal with this myself in the city that I'm currently working with for. I wouldn't take tabs off. And just because you stumbled into two good reasons for somebody, there's a vast more number of them that are not valid. Most, and it's not like you're out going and checking everybody's tabs and everybody's driveway. You've come on this because someone's generated a complaint. Someone has said,
exactly.
Hey, I'm concerned about this. This is what's going on. My neighbor's not being a good neighbor, and I have these issues, and I'm hoping you can do something to protect me and my neighbors from someone who's not being neighborly. So you go out there and you start checking boxes, and the fact that its tabs are expired, you know, you can use discretion. If the guy says, I'm saving it for my kid who's going to give it to him in 6 months, we're going to license it then, or my son's in the Navy, that's fine. But, you know, my son's in the Navy, and guess what? His car's got tabs, and he doesn't drive it. He's been gone a lot, but he's got tabs, and when he comes in, he jumps in and he drives around. He doesn't have to go deal with tabs. So even though that might happen occasionally, it's rare. And the likelihood that you would be called out to somebody who's done nothing more than a grandfather saving this beautiful, cherry, nice little truck and just forgot to get the tabs. So I'm just saying, I want all the tools you can to address this because I understand the circumstances where you're going out to address them. You're not just driving around looking for tabs.
Right, absolutely not. But believe it or not, people tend to use code enforcement as a tool when they're having a fight with their neighbors. And
I do believe that, and that's not what I'm talking about.
Oh, but I mean, but that is kind of what we.
You guys have done a great job. The fact that you have one property on your radar right now as a concern is wonderful. I've got about 20 in my city that I've got on my, and we're struggling to address them. And I go around town, I haven't seen even one property close to what I'm dealing with out east. So you guys are doing great. I'm just saying, I like tabs. I think people mm-hmm. should, if you're going to have a car, you ought to have your tabs on it. And if you don't, the real reason they're probably not buying the tabs is because of that silly RTA tax that we put on ourselves, and we're paying $300 for those tabs. Well, we voted it in, so pay your share.
I have a car that it's not licensed and hasn't been licensed for a number of years. It's in my garage with Holtzclaw signs on it. But I store it in my garage, so it doesn't meet this stuff because it's not on the street and it's not in a driveway.
Where are people with no cabs storing their vehicles?
Well, the ones that we've had complaints on were in a driveway.
Okay.
So. Right, absolutely. And the cases that we ran into, they were just keeping it in the driveway. So, but that alone didn't seem like really to meet the intent of the code. What we were thinking is the intent was to keep derelict vehicles out of the driveway. And that the police department would be the ones that would be concerned if the car left the driveway and was driving on the street with the fact that it didn't have current tabs. So from a land use perspective, we were looking at it as expired tabs alone didn't really meet the kind of what we thought was the intent.
Tabs alone doesn't. It's part of a package.
Yeah, but the way it's currently written...
I'm on board with the changes. I'm just
saying. Oh, but you want to add tabs to this list.
You know, the fact that it's not licensed properly will be taken into consideration or something to that.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying. Yeah, I like where you're going. I just didn't like losing that as a tool to just, because oftentimes when I go to someone, talk to them, say, look, these tabs expired 2 years ago. And then they're like, yeah, you're right. And then they sort of at least get it off the street and into the driveway. For me, where I'm dealing with, that's a win.
Oh. Okay.
Mark, you're suggesting we add it to this list of another bullet, and it's 4 out of 5? I'm trying to figure out how you do that.
If staff was comfortable with it, I would find a way of keeping tabs on. The tabs by themselves maybe aren't grounds to say you're not compliant, but it's a piece of the puzzle here. You know, that this, if in fact you're not properly licensed, it adds to these other things. Well, I've got a derelict vehicle in my neighborhood that you would not recognize as derelict. It's a Mercedes. It's parked on the road. It's washed up clay, and he goes out once a week and puts air in the flat tire, keeps it full. If he'd let the air run out, and his tabs have been expired for years, but the car doesn't draw attention because people think it's drivable and it looks clean and keeps air in the tire that goes flat. So somebody did address it, and they moved it into the driveway, but it had been on the street for seriously a couple years.
So if you did add it to this list, and it had to meet a certain number of them, and expired tabs was the only thing wrong with it, then it wouldn't be...
Fair enough.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, it doesn't hurt talking. Sometimes just talking to people saying, hey, your vehicle's brought to our attention. This is, you know... what the issue is. We're trying to protect your home value as well. We're not going to allow other neighborhoods. My neighborhood got a pretty strong HOA, so they can address it as well. I'm just chose not to jump in there. But some of my neighboring neighborhoods do not have those aggressive HOAs, and so it's on the city to be the heavy. And usually, and I know you guys don't go out looking unless it's egregious. It's complaint driven.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Yes, there are exceptions.
Yes, yeah. Exceptions to everything.
You have to use wisdom to ferret out silliness. But if it's a legitimate complaint from someone who's tolerated something, perhaps for months or even years, it's time to be candid with the person and get them compliant.
Yeah, I think that still does get at what staff was looking for. If we add the expired tabs to this list, so that if that's the only thing wrong, it doesn't meet it. I think that works. I guess at what staff's looking at.
So I will trust your judgment. I'm just sharing my thoughts.
Yeah.
So we can add it to that and you still have 3 out of 5.
Or 4 out of 5 if you want. I mean, however you guys want to set it.
I love what you're doing. And if you, when you're staying on top of these things, it's much more manageable. If you get, once you start to fall behind on gaining compliance, and one house goes, and then another house goes, and then another house goes, and then this guy takes it a little farther, it really gets to be a challenge. You guys have done a great job for all the years that I've been here. And when we had some annexation areas where we brought in areas that were not held to the same criteria, you managed to get those neighborhoods compliant without generating a lot of complaints. In fact, the only feedback that we received, at least I did, was from neighbors saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. We're so glad to be here. We're so glad that you addressed that. And all of our 10 neighbors here, quality of life's gone up because one person decided, I'll get compliant. I'll do the right thing. And that person didn't come in and say, you guys are terrible. They just did what needed to be done. And phenomenal job on that. I was worried about that, and you guys didn't get credit for it, but well done.
I remember when that happened because I was part of the team that drove around the neighborhoods looking for those boats and RVs. And but yes, as a general rule, we don't look. It is just complaint driven. But is there some consensus on the council about adding expired tabs to this list?
I don't have a problem adding it, but I would argue we need to make it 4 out of 5 because if one of the examples was the grandparent keeping the car and going to Mark's example, if it was 3 out of 5 and you had that Mercedes and he's just blowing up the tire, if he didn't have his tabs, there's 1. 3 years or older, there's 2. Apparently inoperable. So I don't think I have concerns that we may be not solving the problem that trying to solve if we add that but not make it 4 out of 5. Four out of five.
I think that seems reasonable to make it 4 out of 5. We could bring that back with that added. Oh, okay. Actually, that was the end of issue number one. I was just going to ask, did anybody have any more questions on what we're proposing on the first issue? Or any more suggestions outside of the keep adding the expired tabs? Okay. We'll move on to the second issue. The code prohibits commercial vehicles in excess of 6,000 pounds from being parked on a residential lot in a residential zone. Well, what we found is that the 6,000-pound limit is a little bit unrealistic. Maybe, 30 years ago when we adopted the code, it was a little more realistic. But these days, a pickup, I think even an F-150 is more than 6,000. F-250, and those are what you would consider a reasonable personal vehicle, not a commercial vehicle. And so we kind of feel that 6,000-pound limit is too low. We did a little bit of research on it. An F-350, which is probably maybe about the biggest truck that you'd have that was for personal use rather than commercial, that one is somewhere in the 9,000 to 10,000 range. It depends on how many options it has on it. Yes.
So is the concern the weight of the vehicle or the fact that it's commercial?
That it's a big commercial vehicle. And we are also further on, we're adding a definition of commercial vehicle. So this was just one piece of it. One piece of it, we felt like that 6,000-pound limit was too low. Essentially, it made a lot of vehicles. Sure. Oh, that's okay. Let me go ahead and do this one really quick. This is the method that we were going to use to address it. We were going to remove that 6,000-pound qualifier, and we're adding a definition of commercial vehicle. Another thing that actually came up today, I was issuing a home occupation permit, and I noticed that the minimum standards in home occupation permit still references a 6,000-pound vehicle. It's the same issue, so I think that we should address that and make it a 10,000-pound in that section of the code as well. and we want to add a provision prohibiting motorized construction equipment from being stored on a residential lot. And this came up because someone was storing a backhoe in their backyard. Now, it's a reasonable use of a residential lot, maybe to store an RV or a boat that's screened in your backyard, but we don't think it's a reasonable use of a residential lot to store construction equipment. Okay, now we get to the language itself. 1722.080C, commercial vehicles. No commercial vehicles, combination of vehicle and trailer, and we'd be deleting the 6,000 pounds, or any type of motorized construction equipment shall be parked in any lot in a residential zone, except for motorized construction equipment being used in conjunction with an approved construction project. And this one, Planning Commission also discussed this at length, and I think they added the except for equipment being used with a construction project, because they came up with all these things that, well, what if they were doing a remodel on the home? What if this? What if that? So we added that caveat in there so that someone remodeling their home or putting a new roof on wouldn't necessarily be out of compliance with the code. And this is the language that would address the home occupation standards. Right now it says all parking shall be off-street and shall be accommodated by on-site garage and driveway. Gross vehicle weight of any one vehicle shall not exceed 6,000. And in this point, we were going to change it to 10,000 as well, just to be consistent so we don't create an internal inconsistency in the code. And here's your definition for commercial vehicle. And I did take this one from the Department of Transportation. We tried not to recreate them if there was already a good definition out there. Commercial vehicle means any vehicle that is used or maintained for the transportation of persons for hire, compensation, or profit, or is designed, used, or maintained primarily for the transportation of property and commodities, and is a motor vehicle having a declared gross weight in excess of 10,000 pounds, or is a motor vehicle having three or more axles. So this is the definition the Department of Transportation uses for commercial vehicle. Well, I don't think they would. Well, and it says and. It you know, is a transportation for hire and has a gross weight of 10,000 pounds and three or more axles. So I think that would preclude Uber or Lyft from being considered a commercial vehicle.
So is this allowing more commercial vehicles in neighborhoods, or are you making sure that we can...
Making sure that we can... be clear that they're prohibited. Mm-hmm. And part of it is clearing up that 6,000 pounds. But then the other part is defining what a commercial vehicle is, so we can, you know, define that. And also, just making sure that the code is consistent internally. So, yes, we're not trying to allow them. We're trying to prohibit them. And also... construction equipment on a residential lot. We're trying to make sure that's prohibited unless it's being used for an approved remodel, re-roof, et cetera. Did anybody have any questions on this section?
So, I'm trying to think. This is all about appearance in our residential areas. So a home handyman has a van that's the no-window van that has all of his tools in the back. It's under 10,000 pounds, and it says Bob's Handyman all over the side and the back. It's obviously a commercial vehicle. Do I want that in my neighbor's driveway? I don't know. If it's the same van and it has magnetic sign he takes off, so it's just a white van at night, that's a little bit better. But by going to 10,000, are we going to have those vans that today are somewhere else appearing in people's driveways? I'm not sure.
I would say probably not.
So they're still not allowed?
Yes. Thank you.
Unless it has three axles.
We've had a lot of trouble because the example that you're giving, staff was recommending that if it's painted, all that the vehicle is has some painting on the side that says Bob's Handyman, that would not be considered as far as our zoning regulations as a commercial vehicle. Because we have a lot of people that drive similar vehicles. They don't own their own business. They come home at night, they park, and they're all over. And then what happens is you end up in mostly neighbor disputes where people turn in their guy with the F-250 that has the name of his business on the side. You can find a lot of F-250s that just have it in very small letters on the back windshield. And people get upset with their neighbor and they turn them in. So we're trying to deal with the real issue of the commercial vehicles is like the big box vans, the big larger, heavier, that are clearly commercial and not something that somebody, that just because they did painted it differently is a personal vehicle, which is like a lot of times you'll see an F-250 that isn't painted with the signs, and the only difference is it says Bob's Roofing on the side. You know, is it really a land use zoning issue? And it gets us involved in a lot of things that are hard to get involved in.
I was just kind of asking that. I'm trying to think that. I agree with you, Tom. The guy who brings home his box van water heater repair business that was there for a long time, that one is obviously commercial.
And that's over the 10,000 foot, or 10,000 pound.
So commercial vehicles under
10,000
are now going to be allowed in the
neighborhoods? They arguably are now. It's just really difficult to make that interpretation. Someone has an F-250 that says Bob's Roofing on the back of their windshield. Is that a commercial vehicle or not? And it's the same as the neighbor next door that has the exact same truck that doesn't have small lettering that says Bob's Roofing on it. And so,
licenses for vehicles, for commercial vehicles?
I don't think, that's not what we run into when we're enforcing the code. We don't have anything. It's just a license that has tabs on it, and it's a vehicle in the driveway. So this just gets us out of trying to define which one's commercial and which ones aren't based on the weight class and the size of the vehicle. That's what we're trying to get at here because it's very difficult to enforce it the other way.
In all cases, that vehicle is okay as long as it's in a driveway. It's off street is what the code language I'm seeing here states. You can have Bob's Plumbing in your driveway, you just can't have it on the street, correct?
No. Oh, I see what you're talking about. I'm sorry. Yes, that particular section of the code does apply to home occupation permit. So if that, yeah.
What are you doing? It's just talking about getting off the street. It could be in their driveway. It just can't be on the street.
For a home occ, yes. If the vehicle was tied to a home occupation permit, then yes, it would have to be parked in the driveway or the garage.
Daycare.
Pardon?
A daycare?
Try
to give an example that might to help with what you're explaining.
Well, we have all kinds of home occupations. Yes, a daycare is one kind. Somebody technically could have a construction company where the part of the business they do at their home is just the paperwork. And so they might have a truck, like Tom said, that has a sign in the back window. If that was parked in the driveway, it would be fine. That's different, I would say. Right, Tom?
If it's under 10,000, the fact that it has a rack on the top is it's very kind of an arbitrary thing. So this regulations, it would have to be over 10,000. It had to be the box truck and not the van. So we would say that that is okay. That's what's being proposed.
Right.
We're trying to make it so it's clear that it has some objective criteria, that it has more than two axles, that it has over 10,000 feet. But if it's just somebody's van and they happen to have a rack, I mean, what if it's surfboards, you know? At some point, we're trying to draw some clear lines so it's easy for us to enforce and make sense and explain it to people.
It could be.
Yeah.
I was from California.
So the issue is the guy that buys a truck, he runs a construction company, he's trying to work his taxes to his maximum advantage. He's got a business permit for his home office, so the, and then he throws a sticker on the truck and he writes that off. I get it. We're not trying to mess with that.
Right.
Big stuff.
Construction equipment and things like your
stuff. Right, right. And we have a lot, actually the HOMOC section has a long list of minimum standards of things that are permitted or prohibited for HOMOCs. So we have a lot of other tools there to address that kind of a thing. Are we ready to move on?
Yep.
Oh, okay. The third issue, this one's going to be super easy, I hope. The code currently requires all buildings to be maintained in original or better than original condition. And this seems a little bit wishful. The intent, we believe, is that they be maintained in good repair. It's pretty hard to keep something in better than original condition. You'd have to be pretty diligent for that. And true. So, yes, like we said, the intent is to maintain them in good repair. So what we're proposing is 1724030A, all buildings and other structures shall be maintained in good repair by the property owner. We're striking that language about original or better than original. And with respect to exterior appearance and landscaping. Is this one pretty straightforward? Everybody on board with that? Okay. So staff's recommendation is, I guess at this point, maybe to bring it back to the next council meeting with that change in the ordinance regarding the expired tabs, but bring it back as soon as we can get it back on your agenda for adoption.
One more question. Can we clarify the record on one issue? This was a little unusual because I'm used to seeing an ordinance that attaches the proposed code changes. And this one, we are passing an ordinance that would adopt the Planning Commission recommendation, which itself does not have the proposed amendments. It incorporates your staff report. Mm-hmm. And as I was reading through, what stood out to me is in the staff report, under the findings and conclusions, and I'm trying to find the page here.
Okay.
Language that jumped out at me was... And the staff recommendation, notwithstanding, so I went to the minutes of the Planning Commission meetings, and as you referenced,
there wasn't any. Right. That's sort of standard language.
This suggested to me that we're adopting, being asked to adopt something notwithstanding citizens' comments to the contrary. So I just want to make sure the record is clear. There was no citizen testimony in opposition, at least at the hearing. Was there any written comments submitted on this?
No, okay. No comments at all.
So just so the record is clear, there was no citizen testimony, written or oral, before the Planning Commission on these amendments. Okay, thanks.
Okay, so we'll
thank you.
Okay, next up is Exploration Park, Construction Management and Construction
Professional Service Training. Senator Public Works Director is going to be giving this presentation there. Thank you.
Evening, Council. So tonight I'm here to speak about a construction management contract for Exploration Park. Going back a little bit in time, so in December of 2017, in preparation for the construction of Exploration Park, staff advertised for a request for qualifications for a constructability review and also construction management services. Again, this was in December of 2017. We received one RFQ at that time, and that was KPFF Consulting. And part of the contract was awarded to KPFF, and that was the constructability and bidability review. That was completed in March of 2018, and then in April of 2018, we advertised Exploration Park for the first time. As we know, the projects, the bids came in higher than the engineer's estimate and higher than the budget, and so we, council rejected bids, and we re-advertised again for a second time in November of 2018. The current budget for the project is $1.3 million per the adopted CIP, and table one in your packages has a breakdown as to the estimated total cost for the construction phase, and it has the contract that was awarded by council to McLaurin Sons, the contractor, in an amount a little bit over $1 million. It has the KPFF contract that we're discussing tonight for a little bit over $98,000. It has a contract, an amendment, with the designer of record, which is MIG SVR, for approximately $25,000, and then it has a 10% contingency. So clearly the construction phase is estimated to be below the $1.3 million budget. The construction duration and the project contract right now has 100 working days. So working days, of course, being a little different than calendar days, working days have to do with when the contractor can work, and that's based on weather and holidays, et cetera. So 100 working days is a little over, closer to 4 months, actually, in calendar days. And the timeline here, of course, council awarded the contract in December of 2018 to McLaurin Sons, and we have the pre-construction meeting for this project later in this week, on Friday, actually. And then construction would begin in March or April of this year, so in a month or a month and a half, when the ground temperatures are not under the current conditions of freezing. And with 100 working days, we estimate that the project would be completed in October or November, hopefully sooner. We still have to get a schedule from the contractor. So does council have any questions about this contract?
I thought we already approved
this contract. Is that not correct? That's not correct. Back in, must have been January or so, I don't have the exact date, we came, staff came to council for the award of KPFF prior to the award of the construction contract. And at that time, there was discussions about Exploration Park, and the contract was not awarded to KPFF. It was decided that staff would come back to council after the construction was awarded to a contractor. So that's why it's coming back a second time. Now, the first time that it came, it was based on a different bid package. As council is aware, we repackaged Exploration Park. We did lump sum, so this dollar amount is roughly $60,000 less than what the original construction management fee was.
Sure.
Correct. We're advertising for one project engineer. I'm happy to say that the supervising engineer position will hopefully be filled up very soon. There was an offer that was made and accepted, and so currently the position that's being advertised is for a project engineer. That said, the inspection, because of the playground equipment on this project, does have a certain qualification for what's called a CPSI. So that stands for Certified Playground Safety Inspector. And then the inspector has to have that technical qualification, which KPFF does have that. That's one of the reasons why the engineer, unless he or she has that qualification, they would not be able to inspect this project. We're also, the other thing that comes to mind is we have in 2019 a delivery of a little over $7 million in the CIP, and if I decommission the one engineer and put him or her for 4 to 5 months on one project, it'll be much more difficult to deliver the CIP.
Management and inspection services for the parking exploration.
Preservation Park project in the amount not to exceed $98,374. Do you have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Passed unanimously. Next up is ratification of the proclamation of local emergency.
Thank you, ma'am. So on Monday morning, on February 11th, I issued a proclamation for a local emergency because the storm event that we were experiencing was severe enough that to be beyond our local resources. And although I terminated that proclamation of emergency, nonetheless, our code and our comprehensive emergency management plan requires that the council ratify that decision as early as possible. The purpose for declaring that emergency was one that allowed us to gain access to resources that were needed, mainly plowing and sanding of our streets. And then secondly, it would allow for us to recover some of those expenses to the extent that available money is there from state government. So I'm here this evening seeking your authorization, or ratification rather, to the proclamation of local emergency that I issued on February 11th,
2019.
There is a time frame, and I'm not certain what kind of tail that has on it, since the local emergency was issued. Well, the proclamation was issued on the 11th. It is a comprehensive process to request funds, and depending upon the amount, sometimes it's easier not to request funds, just given the paperwork and the administrative burden that it places upon agencies to recover those funds.
But, snow policy
stuff is
different than, like,
yes.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Passed unanimously.
And Bob, I know I speak for a lot of people up here. Compliments, incredible compliments to your staff, to the city employees. We saw them out there working 10, 12 hours, clearing out branches. It was a tough storm, and I was really, really, really proud to be a citizen of Mill Creek. Nice job.
Oh, well, on their behalf, thank you. They did a great job. That's true.
Is the consent agenda approval of checks number 59686 through 59811 and ACH wire transfers in the amount of $1,767.94.
No exceptions?
No exceptions.
The payroll and benefit ACH payments in the amount of $204,917.11.
No exceptions.
No exceptions.
So do we have a motion to approve?
Oh, second.
So we have a motion and a second to approve the consent agenda. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Audience communication? Go ahead. It's down here.
We do audience after reports, but it doesn't matter.
Go ahead.
Okay, Sean Duffy, 4109 134th Place, Southeast Mill Creek. A couple items in reference to the farm. I appreciate the presentation, reference back to the stated plan for the East Urban Gateway Village. That was done in 2008. Things have changed significantly since then. We have a lot more apartments down 128th now. So I think we ought to reconsider the fact that it demands to have high-density housing there. I'd like for the council to take that into consideration, that things have changed in the last 11 years. Second of all, the traffic study is factually incorrect. It states 300 living units there. As we heard, it's more than 350. Also,
Not sure about the retail space, but we heard this evening that retail space is now 100,000 square feet. So was the traffic study done with retail space at 100,000 square feet or 76,000 square feet? It's the traffic study says that it meets the level of service today, but with the increases that we've seen, I'd like to know that it still meets the level of services. Impact fees are worthless, in my opinion. $1 million is not going to do anything for the traffic. What's it going to do? Put in another street light? I mean, another stoplight? We've got enough of those. They don't work as it is. You sit through a light, and by the time it turns red again, you haven't even moved. We talked about the property tax income that's going to come in with this, $200,000. I think that's nothing as well. With having all these additional apartments, that can decrease the local property taxes around there, which it could offset the property tax income that's going to be brought in by these additional 400 units. We talked about in the area there, a high-end steakhouse coming in there. I don't particularly see workforce housing residents using a high-end steakhouse very often. And if the city of Mill Creek really could use that, why isn't there one here now? I'm concerned that what it is going to bring in is a lot more places that we already have a lot of around Mill Creek, and concerned that it's going to end up with more empty storefronts like we already have today. Those are the concerns I have now. Thank you for your time.
We had some time ago said that we wanted to do a proclamation about Black History Month, and so we went ahead and working with the city manager and staff, we prepared one. I'm sorry it's late, because snow last week. So here's what it says. Whereas the city of Mill Creek takes pride in recognizing February 2019 as Black History Month, a time dedicated to remembering and celebrating Black culture, history, contributions, and sacrifices made to create a brighter future for all Americans. And whereas Black History Month celebrates the achievements of African Americans who have been instrumental in shaping the character, culture, and economic life of our state and nation. And whereas Dr. Carter G. Woodson, founder of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, first launched Negro History Week in 1926 and is widely regarded as the father of Black history. And whereas in 1976, the informal expansion of Negro History Week to Black History Month was officially recognized by the United States government. And whereas the 2019 theme, Black Migrations, focuses specifically on the movement of people of African heritage to new destinations and social realities in the 20th century, it does not forget the millions of early Africans who were forcibly taken to the Americas. And whereas Black History Month is an occasion to rediscover the enduring stories of African Americans and the gifts of freedom, purpose, and opportunity they have bestowed on future generations, it is also time to commemorate the countless contributions of African Americans, many of whom lived through and surmounted the scourge of segregation, racial prejudice, and discrimination. Now, therefore, I, Cam Pruitt, the mayor of the city of Mill Creek, on behalf of the city council, do hereby proclaim the month of February 2019 as Black History Month and ask all residents of Mill Creek to join me in commemorating the countless contributions of African Americans to our nation and the world. So thank you to the staff for helping to prepare this.
Thank you, Mayor. Just want to say thank you, Christy, for a really good presentation on, we had some political challenges to it, and that the breaking down the history that brings from to here. And we get you reports, and all the reports tonight were good, but nice job, Christy.
I'll be attending the Planning Commission meeting on Thursday night where they take up the small wireless communications facilities issue. So I'll report back next week.
Thanks. A couple of things. I put this on your desk in front of you. This is, I just, I find this important. It's something to watch out for. It's been a year of meetings we've been going through. They're getting down to the end of it. The draft reports will come out. I'll let you know that report for consumption. I want to share this little infographic. It's just ridiculous stuff. It's going to be some things that impact our needs of topic insights. 1.8 million people. Statewide, how do we deal with affordable housing? We heard about some of that tonight. How do you find that
So I guess in short, I do agree with Councilmember Todd that a lot of these bills are bad for, I think, cities in general and also for the city of Mill Creek. Many times you play defense with the legislature, and that's sort of the position we're in again here. I focused on the bills that AWC had listed on as recommending to oppose rather than those that have been support just because of the time frame that I had this afternoon. I didn't look at all the bills in the opposed column, but I did review all of the land use bills. And although they fit in the one of three categories. They're either being promoted to promote affordability, they're being promoted to reduce sprawl, or they're being promoted to advance transit or development. And although I think a lot of those elements and all three of those categories are good policy-type decisions, they are decisions that I believe are best left to the local entity. And all of these bills, I believe, erode the local control that has really been embedded in GMA and that cities have practiced for years. And they're a bit heavy-handed, at least in my view, in terms of what they're attempting to do. And again, they're probably best decisions that individual cities make rather than being mandated or forced from the state. And so to the extent that Councilmember Todd or others are in Olympia and they're able to communicate the city's opposition to those bills, I would recommend doing that in addition to the, you remember in December you passed three legislative priorities in addition to the legislative priorities that AWC was supporting or in this case opposing to also get behind. So I can talk in, directly about some of the land use issues if you want more information about some of those, but generally they all just go a little too far, in my view, in terms of interfering with local decision-making.
Tom,
sometimes once they get a little bit of legs on them, then it gets sort of, because right now there's just so many out there. So you kind of wait to see what comes out of this committee and then you start sort of gearing up to oppose or to support them. One of the ones I don't see on here that I think is really important is to try to align the time frames of all the deadlines for all the studies and when the GMA mandates are due and when the census information is available. Because right now it's sort of a hodgepodge and it creates a lot of consternation. It would be kind of nice if they sort of had it organized like every 10 years or so, sort of instead of 8 years for some, and this study's due in 5 years, every 5 years, and they just don't really line up very well. So there's been some talk about trying to sort of align those. I don't see that on here yet, but it may be proposed, but that's something I would like to look for.
I think the number was 2,000 bills.
Challenging time.
You'll meet again with your executive search firm for the city manager candidates, and so that's the date that you're scheduled to identify or to review the candidates that have applied for the position. And so I'm here to ask whether or not you'd like to start that meeting earlier. The executive search firm believes they would need between 45 and 90 minutes for a discussion executive session with council. He's available at 5 o'clock if you wish to start earlier. You don't see a lot of things on the agenda for March 5 through 12, but keep in mind that we also purposely didn't add any future discussions beyond the development agreement coming to you on the farm. So that could be an item that also is on the 5th or the 12th additionally. So if you're available at 5 on the 12th, I would schedule that with them. Otherwise, we'll just start at that at 6 with the exec session, and then 45 to 90 minutes later, you'll resume your regular meeting.
Start it at 5 and then go until we get this done and then start our regular meeting?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. I have to check with my husband because he comes home for daycare to watch our daughter be here at 6. So I'll have to confirm with that. They can be home for the entire one.
Okay, could you both let Bob know? And then we can call a special meeting if it works out.
No, I just wanted to get you to think about that and let me know so that we then could let the search firm know to arrive at 5, or we'll just start at 6.
We can also then, if they can't
make it, we can adjust
the schedule
or move
stuff to the
5th
and keep it
12.
90 minutes of this is a lot of work.
Yes. We can try to accommodate that again. You control a lot of that schedule in terms of how quickly you want to move and how much discussion you want to have on the farm development, which I believe will be the consuming element on your agendas over the next month. Six, because it becomes a little bit difficult to manage the day for interviews. But yeah, that would be the date that you would effectively pick your semi-finalist, if you will, to be interviewed on the 22nd and then the 23rd. To discuss them, but I think he was planning on distributing that information to you prior to the meeting.
That's what I'm trying to figure out. So we would have to have confidence in that that we had a chance to read through, but we would be certain out of time. He can say, here's what I saw, and we're going to chime in with what we saw. So now.
And it would be very common. Also, I would expect the executive search firms to do some preliminary interviews, phone conversations with a number of candidates before he brings to you the recommended 5 or 4 or 6 or whatever number it would be. So some of that would have taken place prior to the 12th. Yeah, I suspect you're not going to get a packet of just whatever he's recommending. You'll get a packet of all the candidates to the extent you want to review all of those applicants.
Is there anything else tonight? Okay,
we just want to brief report just to, again, we're following up on the storm event. You're going to get more information in terms of our look back at how we can do things differently and better going forward, but I just wanted to have Gina give me some highlights of the activities that took place during the storm event over the last week and a half.
You have to extend the 5 minutes?
I think you can do it less than that.
Second to extend to 840, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
So really briefly, in these few minutes, I will echo what council said about our crew. They have been fabulous. We only have 4.7 FTEs, full-time employees, but they have the heart of many. So I just wanted to put that out there for the record and extend my gratitude to them for their personal commitment to the city of Mill Creek. Second, it's not over. If you look at the weather forecasts, I was able to glance whatever can be forecasted through March 5th, and we continue in this dance of temperatures in the low 40s and then right at freezing. So we will continue dealing with some icing. There, depending on the forecast that you see, there may be some snow showers, et cetera. So we're in this for the long run. We're not done. As Bob mentioned, the declaration of an emergency for the city of Mill Creek really helped staff to look at resources available to help our crew in handling the road conditions. The declaration happened on the morning of February 11th at around 8 o'clock, and by 8 p.m. we had KOB Construction demobilized with appropriate equipment here in the city of Mill Creek, and plowing our state routes, State Route 96, State Route 527, and our hills. So the declaration of an emergency for the city was a necessity in order to be able to serve our residents appropriately. KOB Construction was the contractor that helped us for those for our streets and also for plowing our parking lots. So here at City Hall, the Annex Building, and the library that also needed attention. At this time, and looking forward, the crew, starting tomorrow, will be focusing on Seattle Hill Road. As you, I'm sure, are familiar, there's tree branches that are protruding into the sidewalks and also into some of the traveling lanes at some locations, so that's our next focus. We're going to be looking at potholes also on Seattle Hill Road, and there are other locations in the city where we're seeing more and more potholes, and this is a normal thing that happens when you have a weather event like this. The water gets in through the cracks, and it just weakens the pavement, and you start seeing potholes. We also will continue sweeping our roads with all the sand application. That's part of the result of the and necessary cleanup, and continue applying de-icer. As I mentioned, we still have freezing temperatures for the foreseeable future. We will continue also another thing that I'm interested in, and it's a philosophy that I have for the department, is continuous improvement, lessons learned. We did a great job. Again, I think we also should feel very proud of the crew that the city has. We want to look at, in the event of a future storm or some other disaster or declaration, et cetera, what can we do better? How can we communicate better, et cetera? So we're also, as we're going through these next few days, that's something that we'll be looking at. Correct. Thank you.
Another area that's sometimes overlooked, too, in something like this is communication. And I think Joni and her team did a great job at keeping the city informed as to what's going on, what's happening, where are we at, what's being plowed. I know I received, as a council member, a lot of feedback from residents saying how happy they were that they were able to be communicated with. It's something that if you don't do it, you hear a lot about it. When you do it, it's kind of something that doesn't get talked about a lot. But kudos to the communications and marketing group. That was just as important, I think, also as getting getting those streets cleared.
Absolutely, and I want to point out, as council's aware, and I think the public's aware, we had our sweeper, our sander fail on Monday, February 4th, so even before the big storm came in. And because of social media, a person from the Emergency Management Department in Bothell learned about it and connected us to the city of Sammamish. So typically in an event like this, my first reaction is to coordinate with the local county, which would be Snohomish County, and we did that. What we learned from this, too, again, lessons learned, continuous improvement, is that sometimes staying with your local county may not be sufficient, and we need to expand to neighboring counties such as King County. That's where we found our sander.
Okay, anything else? Okay, with that, we are adjourned at 8:30 a.m.